Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. General Robert H. Scales, U.S. Army retired, joins us today to discuss firepower and the American way of war. American military thinking often centers around firepower, the delivery of explosive power against an enemy. Ironically, firepower has real nuance to it. Popular discussion often uses the term conducting strikes to gloss over a vast vocabulary of missiles, bombs, and shells used in a myriad of ways against a myriad of targets to varied effect. Today, General Scales will move us beyond both Michael Bay and CNN to get at the more in-depth understanding of firepower's use, effectiveness, and place in the American psyche. That and more after this short break.
Hola nuestros amigos. Do you like Sea Control? Do you enjoy the SimSec Next World blog? Become part of the discussion and our community. Sign up for SimSec membership at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and podcasts emailed to you every week, and an account that allows you to submit articles directly to our editors through WordPress. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, but it's nothing without your constant support and engagement. Your ideas keep us going. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
And welcome back, everyone. We are joined today by Major General Robert H. Scales, Jr., United States Army retired. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
He is the 44th Commandant of the U.S. Army War College, and you started a 34-year career as an artilleryman. You fought in Vietnam at the Battle of Hamburger Hill, but there's so much to your career. I'm going to turn it over to you. Sir, what do you think are the important beats? Where are you coming from? What should our listeners know about General Scales?
Well, I guess from the time I was in graduate school, I've always held an interest for the relationship between firepower in the American way of war. My doctoral dissertation at Duke was on firepower in small wars. Later in the late 80s, I wrote a book called Firepower in Limited War, and that book was a series of case studies that looked at the use of supporting fires. By that I mean artillery, mortars, close air support, attack helicopters, and naval gunfire in various battles, beginning with the First Indochina War, the Second Indochina War. Believe it or not, the Soviets in Afghanistan. Remember, I wrote this in the 80s. And the Falklands and the Iraq War. I wasn't able to get the Korean War in simply because I ran out of space. And ever since I decided after leaving graduate school that I'd write sort of a magnum opus that I would call Firepower in American Wars. Unfortunately, the challenges of the career, writing other books on other subjects, and after retirement running a business, it just got away from me. And I've had to give up, even though I've spent almost 40 years collecting documents, doing studies, writing essays, doing dozens of articles on the use of firepower, and lecturing all over the world on the subject. And so my original intent was to explain the American obsession with firepower, relate it to America's industrial production, its love of technology, but apply it only to the tactical and operational levels of war. I left strategic bombing and the bombing of German and Japanese cities for other historians. I was really focused on firepower support of the maneuver battlefield, of ground forces. And so over the years, I think I've accumulated sort of a unique perspective on Americans' love affair with firepower, and that's led to, as I said, some controversial pieces that I've written over the years, and a sort of contrarian view, if you will, about the relationship between American strategy and firepower. I guess the seminal moment was sitting on Firebase Berchtesgaden, looking through a BC scope at Hamburger Hill. And over a period of, oh gosh, I guess altogether probably 2 months, I watched hundreds of air sorties every day. I myself fired upwards of 1,100 to 1,200 rounds a day at that hill. I called in and coordinated the fires from 155 8-inch 175 onto that tiny little piece of real estate. And day after day, week after week, month after month, the NVA simply came out of their holes, cooked their rice on open fires, and then ducked back into their bunkers when the firepower started. And so I said to myself back then, you know, there's got to be more to this than simply the pyrotechnic effects of firepower, and that our American obsession with firepower has to either be misplaced or overestimated. And so all of my works, beginning with the dissertation, the books, and subsequent books, all have focused on a reality check on the benefits and the liabilities of the use of firepower to support ground forces.
Wow, I almost don't have to introduce the topic. You've done it in fine form, but for those who aren't able to tell already, this is the topic of today's podcast. So you're wondering, well, okay, it's a maritime security podcast. They've got an army general here. What the purpose here is to get at exactly what you said, that reality check. We talk about security, we talk about war. Ordnance seems to be either a side thing or something we see in Michael Bay movies where everything is being exploded and destroyed, but there's a real physics to that. There's a real ballistics. There's a real impact. The kind of munitions we use, the kind we design, how we use them, they all have an impact, and it seems to always be a side story to the larger narrative, and we want to bring that into focus today, and General Scales is the perfect guy. So, sir, let's tap into that vast body of work that you have behind you. And what is that American culture of firepower? What is it that you looked at and you said you saw as the constant strain in sort of that mentality that drives Americans to, you know, firepower? And I won't lie, I'm one of those guys. If it's big, if it explodes, Americans love it. Americans watch it.
Yeah.
But then it leaks into what the kinds of munitions we buy, which might be a problem.
Yeah.
So I'll just throw that to you.
Well, I guess the thing that really ties us all together is a wonderful quote by the British Colonel G.F.R. Henderson, who wrote the biography of Stonewall Jackson. And remember, this is a Brit. And he got reports from British observers in the Civil War. And he said, these Americans are crazy. Instead of charging with a bayonet like we Europeans like to do, they just sat back 1,000 yards apart and blasted each other with artillery and musket fire. He said they waste thousands of rounds of artillery and musket ammunition without closing. He says this is something that's uniquely American. And it remained that way through the two world wars and all of our small wars since. And the other thing I found so interesting was that when I did my research in graduate school, I ran across a series of classified studies that were done in the 50s that basically ask a very simple question. How does firepower really kill? All of this came out of the Korean War, where the stark realities of inability to dislodge the enemy by firepower came to light. It even goes back to the two seminal battles in the Pacific, in Iwo Jima and Okinawa, where the Japanese actually used our obsession of with firepower against us. General Usajima, the commander in Okinawa, was, believe it or not, commandant of the Japanese War College, and he studied it. And he said, you know, these Americans really believe that they can use firepower against us to substitute for manpower, that they can use the explosive effects of firepower to save lives, and I'm going to turn that against them. This is the Japanese general talking. I'm going to use a series of tactics that will mitigate the killing effects of American firepower. And I'll just kill a lot of Americans, not because I want to achieve some objective, because he knew he was going to die, but he said, I want to change American attitudes about the feasibility of invading Japan. Well, of course, the atom bombs changed all of that, but Usajima was on to something. He understood that Americans' obsession with firepower could be used against him. So these studies after the Korean War said, how effective really is this stuff? And what they discovered in a series of controlled experiments was amazingly very little. If you fire, surprise fire, you drop bombs against, the phrase they use, was unworn, unprotected troops, the lethal effects are staggering. You'll kill dozens of people, as we've seen in some of the terrorist mortar attacks in places like Baghdad and Fallujah and in Aleppo and places like that. If the target is innocents and they're in the open, unwarned, unprotected, it can be enormously and terribly destructive. But if you add a couple of components to that, the probability of killing someone with any amount of firepower goes virtually to zero. And those things are being protected, digging in, dispersing, camouflaging yourself, and building overhead protection. If you do all of those things, then as I saw on Hamburger Hill in Vietnam, and as we've seen in subsequent wars, then the ability to kill the enemy with firepower decreases several orders of magnitude. And the other thing that's interesting is that over time, the enemy adapts. And so what starts off early in a war as horribly depressing and psychologically intimidating firepower eventually is something that's shrugged off. The enemy gets inured to the pyrotechnics effect of firepower, and over time, they actually get to the point of ignoring it. I use as an example the Battle of Vinh Nhang in 1951, when the French used napalm for the first time against the Viet Minh. Well, they thought it was the atom bomb. They won that battle decisively, and yet 3 years later, at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the Viet Minh were completely insulated, if you will, against the overwhelming firepower that the French used against them. And years later, at Khe Sanh, the Viet Cong, or the NVA, thought they could repeat that at the Battle of Khe Sanh. Of course, it turned out that that their tactics were badly put together, and firepower defeated the NVA. And so in every war we fought, to include, I might add, the bombing against ISIS today, expectations are high, and the results are always disappointing. And whether it's in Iwo Jima, Okinawa, Hamburger Hill, if it's in Korea, or even if it's the Israelis in Gaza, when the infantry finally go in, following a firepower barrage by air and ground systems, inevitably they're always shocked at the power of the resistance. And there's scientific reasons for that. It's not just something that should surprise us. But in war after war, occasion after occasion, Americans are always surprised at the lack of effects of firepower. One other example I'll give you is in Afghanistan. One of the things that we learned in these so-called WEWOT studies in the 50s is that the killing power of supporting fires is not related to the power of the explosive, but it's related to the number of explosive points. Very interesting. And so that's why we came up with submunitions, cluster bombs, if you will, artillery and air-delivered cluster bombs. All of a sudden, the lethality curve jumped upwards. And so instead of being like 0.005 for killing effective artillery, it jumped up to as much as, 0.5, 0.9 killing power for the use of submunitions. But what did we do? Well, we banned the use of submunitions in Afghanistan. And as one of my studies shows, the least productive type of terrain for the use of any type of firepower is in rocky mountainous terrain. And if you have a point detonating munition, like artillery or bombs, if the enemy is in mountainous terrain and if he's protected by rocks in mountainous terrain, the odds of you hurting him with mortars or artillery or air power is virtually zero.
I've got a follow-up on that, but to your point about the Civil War, taking it all the way back to the roots and Henderson's observations about charging with bayonets, so you've shown this constant historical narrative of the way Americans view firepower, and before we figure out why we can't learn, let's look at the root of that. Where do you think that cultural perspective on firepower, on artillery, about explosions, on that concept of indirect, where does that all come from? Where are we getting that?
It's very interesting, and that's a great question. I think it comes from two sources. Number one is that firepower is the surest way to translate American industrial power into effectiveness on the battlefield. Rifle and machine gun bullets don't do it because the enemy can make as many rifle and machine gun bullets as we can. But when you add sophisticated explosive power, that works its way back down the chain, if you will, to the factories in America that produce artillery pieces, fighter planes, mortars, rockets. That's something that is a uniquely American capability. And whether it's making Liberty ships or B-17 bombers or aircraft carriers, it's all the same motive factor, is that maybe if we just overwhelm them with weight of shell, that's the surest way of translating American technology. Now, you could say, well, what about maneuver? What about the use of operational maneuver forces? The truth is, all the way, even through World War II, we didn't have a lot of confidence in our ability to do that, and we didn't do it very well. If you look at the German accounts of their defense around the Normandy beachhead, they poo-pooed both British and American use of armor. They thought that our maneuvers to break out of the bridgehead were amateurish and poorly executed, poorly planned. But they always had a respect for, during the breakout, for American firepower. And once the breakout started with our use of tactical fighter aircraft, the so-called Yabos that the Germans feared. So in a way, you could say that American expectations were met in the early days of World War II. But the problem is, of course, over time, the Germans learned how to defeat American firepower. And as we got later and later in the war, until probably until January 1945, the Germans, like all our other enemies, had learned how to mitigate the killing effects of American firepower. So you're left with two alternatives. One alternative is to sacrifice human lives to gain ground, which is what we did in places like the Hürtgen Forest and Hamburger Hill and Porkchop Hill, or you increase the use or the tonnages that you use to achieve ever diminishing effects. So pretty soon that curve of expenditures versus the curve of killing effects begin to converge. And then all of a sudden, you're left with two unacceptable choices. Attack against an enemy inured to your use of firepower, or continue to add on firepower till you reach the point of diminishing returns.
About the idea of bigger, badder explosions, I'm thinking about, like, historically, you look at guys like Lieutenant Sims, and he was the, as B.J. Armstrong calls him, the gun doctor, increasing the accuracy of American naval gunnery, and then
right.
I'm skipping a whole bunch of things and we're moving on to the Cold War where the Soviet Union said...
Well, just and hang on a second. Let's talk about that because you bring up a good point. If you look at Marine Corps doctrine in the 30s, the Marines came up with the idea that they would never have the ship capacity to store away and deliver to, across the beachhead the amount of artillery that the Army was going to use in World War II. The Army had 8-inch guns, 240 howitzers, 155 guns, 155 howitzers. They had a ratio of artillery to infantry that exceeded more than 1-to-1. The Marines never had 1-to-1. So their thought was, we'll do it with two things. We'll either do it with close air support using Dauntless dive bombers, or the key to it all, as the Navy believed, we'll use naval gunfire. And I have to say, probably the most useless pound-for-pound form of support for maneuver forces historically is naval gunfire. If you look at the effectiveness of naval gunfire against fixed installations ashore, almost always the fixed installations win, whether it's the Revolution or the British shelling of Egyptian forts or the bombardments at Iwo Jima, Peleliu, or Okinawa. Naval gunfire, because it's flat trajectory, even with high-capacity battleship guns, very limited explosive effects, and accurate in azimuth, but terribly inaccurate. I mean, I'm sorry, accurate in deflection, but terribly inaccurate in range. If the target's flat and the enemy's dug in, naval gunfire, dare I say it, based on past experiences, is virtually useless. And the Marines learned that painfully on Iwo Jima, where they created a moonscape that really turned out to have little or no effect, and they really learned it in Okinawa. The constant pounding by sea-based firepower virtually gave zero return on investment.
Well, after that beating that the Navy's just took, I'm glad you brought that up, but the issue that I wanted to get to was that something that it seems like we have learned or we've attempted to learn is, okay, we try to bring that overwhelming firepower, but, I was about to say with the Soviet Union, they say, you know, we're going to build the Tsar Bomba, screw accuracy, I'm going to build the biggest bomb I can so I don't have to hit a target. And we increasingly built more and more and more precise munitions. So when you talk about that lack of learning, you know, it seems like part of that process, you look at drone strikes, and you look at JDAMs, and we focus in on the ability to deliver incredibly precise munitions. But like you're saying right now, it looks like we're learning on the delivery process. It doesn't look like we're learning on the side of the types of ordnance that we deliver or what their effect is going to be.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, the beauty of precision munitions is that they're very precise. If your ability to locate targets is imprecise, then they're almost always precisely wrong. When I did my study of Gulf War firepower, what I found is that the Air Force claimed that something like 70% of all the tanks killed in the 38-day air bombardment were caused by precision munitions. The truth was, I actually sent my teams out to Kuwait and Iraq to actually slugger in. Slugger is an early form of GPS. Slugger in the actual targets. And it turned out that precision munitions had virtually no effect against Iraqi armor. And dumb bombs had even less effect against Iraqi armor. The only thing that was precise enough to actually kill tanks were Maverick missiles and Hellfire missiles, and those were used so sparingly that they had virtually zero impact on point targets used by the Iraqis. Fast forward to Iraq and Afghanistan, very similar picture. If you don't have precise target location, if the enemy hides and uses deception to hide his actual critical points, and you apply precision munitions with great precision and they hit the wrong stuff, the effect is zero. So in many ways, America's walking away from airy munitions, the so-called steel rain that was so effective in Desert Storm, and it was extremely effective, literally means that the gross killing effect of American firepower without bomblet munitions and with precision is very problematical, particularly on a maneuver battlefield where the enemy has the ability to move, to displace, to hide, and to deceive, all the precision. And if you have one meter accuracy against a target you can't identify, you have zero kill probability.
So then what is it that's preventing us from learning? So we've got, do we just overestimate the psychological effect, or is this, because like you've said, you know, you use submunitions, you use these larger area of effect, these that have a larger effect over an area. Is this just a natural part of America's...
Yeah, that's a great question, because the last refuge of the firepower community, when you conclusively prove that they've had a little or no real effect on killing the enemy, is this whole idea of psychological impact. We used to call it suppression. That is that the pyrotechnic effects, the bang, the explosion, the fire, the dust, all those things that you see coming up out of the streets of Gaza City, those huge mushroom clouds, that must be the thing that makes American firepower effective. And actually, initially in a conflict, that's probably true, because if you've ever been shelled, and I have several times, it is emotionally debilitating, to say the least. But in truth, over time, the enemy gets used to it, and the so-called suppressive effects of firepower is reduced to virtually zero. You know, it's the image of the early days in World War One of the British at Mons and Lake Cateau being forced out of their positions by the Germans' use of howitzers, and you fast forward 3 years to the battles of Passchendaele and Ypres, and you find pictures of the British Tommies standing on a firing step brewing tea in the middle of a German barrage. The curve of dissipation for the suppressive and psychological effects of firepower is even steeper downward than the actual killing effects of firepower. And that's something that those who deliver firepower, particularly aerial firepower, simply refuse to admit.
How much is driven by the requirement, or, you know, in Iraq, in some areas of Afghanistan, in Libya, the places that we're striking, there's civilians using submunitions, it seems it has a higher killing effect, but that killing effect then creates more collateral damage. Are we necessarily not learning the lessons, or are we accepting an operational risk and saying, I understand these munitions aren't as effective, but I'm not looking to maximize, I'm relying on that precision rather than that killing power.
See, that's very interesting. In World War II, and particularly in the Pacific theater, although also true in the European theater, no one really cared if your bombs went long or if your artillery shot long, because all you did was just kill another German or another Japanese, and we sort of sloughed that off. But beginning in the Korean War, with the death of innocent Koreans, and of course in my war, Vietnam, with the death of innocent Vietnamese, all of a sudden the friction induced by fear of collateral damage was another factor that depressed the killing quotient of firepower. In other words, there was not only a psychological and physical limit to the amount of munitions you could pour into an area, there was also a moral limit to it as well. And of course, the enemy then, in turn, knows this, doesn't care about the death of civilians. And so, as in virtually all wars since the end of Korea, the enemy tends to hide among the people, as a means of mitigating the killing effects of American firepower. So there's a limit on killing effects that it's induced by public outrage, by the media, by those who accuse us of committing war crimes, by the whole concept of proportionality in combat. All of those things, at the very time when we want to rely more and more on firepower substituting for manpower, the moral dimension is the third dimension that reduces the actual ability of us to use firepower, particularly in this new era of warfare.
Let's try, and perhaps this is your life's work, and so answering this question won't be so easy, but triangulating that solution. So we've talked about the moral dilemma of the increased killing capacity in civilian areas, trying to find that balance. You've talked about manpower over firepower, and that suggests that the replacement for firepower would be manpower. Is the modern day drone that has that ability to accurately find someone and use firepower, is that the solution? And of course, I mean, saying is it the solution is partially asinine because I'm saying singular things. But what do you see as the solution to that proper balance? Is it more ships, more people, more things on scene? Is it solving that accuracy problem to a better degree? Is it accepting more risk in order to more quickly defeat an enemy? What do you see as the proper path forward?
So there's several factors that affect what you're talking about. Let's just go down those. The first is proximity. One of the things that in our zeal to embrace bombing and precision bombing is we forgot about proximity. In other words, the closer you can bring in killing power to an enemy in proximity to American forces, the killing effects literally spike out of sight. If you can deliver ordnance within 100 meters of friendly troops who must expose themselves in the final assault, then all the charts are just blown up. The deaths on the part of the enemy are overwhelming. So that's the first thing. Second is this idea of dwell time. How quickly can you get not only something on station, but something on station with the right combinations of desired effects makes a huge difference. The third is something called munitions target fit. If you're dropping napalm on tanks, that doesn't work. If you're firing 16 inches against maneuver forces, it's impossible. So being able to match the munition with the target is important and almost impossible with close air support. But the most important single element in all of this is what folks call target location. And we in the American military have spent more money on aircraft and munitions than we have on the ability to locate targets with precision. All this is starting to change thanks to the success of drone strikes in the last 5 or 6 years. So more money spent on locating to within a meter and tracking the movement of the target offers a far greater return on investment in killing power than simply buying more airplanes and more bombs. And our greatest, and the final one, the fifth one, I guess, is this idea of intimacy. Regardless of what the Air Force and Navy will tell you, the idea of trust that's built through an intimate association between the three key elements of firepower, that is the observer, unit on the ground, the decision maker, and the deliverer, pilot or ship. An intimate association, habitual relationship between those three, is the second greatest factor that increases the killing effect of firepower. Unfortunately, we've done very poorly on the two most important factors in increasing the effectiveness of firepower, and committed ourselves almost solely to precision killing effects explosive effects and the delivery systems, which now are coming in at something like $1.5 trillion. It's way off base, And Americans, decision makers, military leaders simply don't have this fingertip understanding of the realities of firepower, and therefore they continue to make terrible, terrible decisions about what to buy and how to employ it.
And General, we will leave it there. I, you know, we have to leave something for your book, right? but there's so much more we could get into. But before we leave, what I'd like to do is, do you have anything that you're working on that you've done in the past that you'd recommend? Is there something, some work that you've been recently reading or someone else's work that you'd recommend to give the audience a better understanding of what you've come to learn? Where should they go and read or watch or engage to better get an understanding of this issue of ordnance?
I think the principal thing that I'm just beginning to explore is the interrelationship between psychology and firepower, between the human dimension and our obsession with pyrotechnic effects and the killing effects of firepower. I think we have yet to really understand what goes on between the ears of your enemy or what goes on between the ears of those who are using firepower and correlating those two factors. I think that sadly, the people who make decisions about the use of firepower neither understand the utility of firepower or the impact of firepower on the human psyche. And we have a long, long way to go to understand that. We can do third decimal place estimations of the probability of kill, but we don't have a true understanding of the probability of psychological intimidation. And to me, that's my latest point of exploration. And if anybody can provide me with any insights into that, I'd be eternally grateful.
And you know what? I'll throw this out to the audience as well. General, you mentioned the idea of getting into to the mind of your opponent. And I'm reminded when you say that of the Fog of War documentary, Robert McNamara interviews.
Right.
I found that rather educational as well. Well, General, it has been an absolute pleasure. This has been an education, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Matt.
Great content from the Center for International Maritime Security. Like the Sea Control podcast? It's at your fingertips. Go to www.cimsec.org. Don't forget to sign up at www.cimsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and announcements by email. And hey, if you feel inspired, feel free to write us an article or two, or five. Make sure to check out our partners. Our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute produce the Sea Control Asia Pacific edition. Our friends at the Phoenix Think Tank produce Sea Control East Atlantic. This and other fine forums can be found on our homepage. Join the discussion.